I think what can happen over time is when we can dislodge in our own interior world the fear of an angry God who we have to appease by believing the right things, when we can sort of dislodge from that, then we can come out of our shell a little bit and know that, you know, maybe humans aren't going to like it as much if we believe different things or ask questions, but we can absorb that because we know on some level that God is okay with it.
Hi, everyone. This is Dana Black.
And this is Chelsea Simon.
Welcome to the Collective Table.
Hi, everyone. It's Dana again. As we enter our last month of our second season called What God Looks Like, Chelsea and I sit down with Colby Martin. Chelsea and I were first introduced to author and pastor Colby through his book Unclobber, Rethinking Our Misuse of the Bible on Homosexuality. Pre-COVID. Yep, COVID and its disruptive way of intruding on all of our lives. Colby was scheduled to speak at an in-person event that Chelsea and I were organizing right before the lockdown. So here we are, a year and a half later, and finally having the opportunity to hear Colby's story and talk about his shift from conservative Christianity to progressive affirming Christianity. You can also read about his journey in his second book titled The Shift: Surviving and Thriving After Moving from Conservative to Progressive Christianity. As allies, Colby, along with his wife, Kate, co-pastor Sojourn Grace Collective in San Diego. Yes, they're our neighbors. Not literally, but they are only about 30 minutes away from us. For anyone, queer or straight, who are in a conservative Christian environment and find themselves struggling, wrestling, or questioning why LGBTQIA+ individuals cannot be incorporated into the full body of the church, and this means hold leadership roles and have marriage rights, this is the episode for you to listen to. Our queer brothers and sisters are beloved children of God, holy and exactly as they are, and must be incorporated into the full body of Christ's church. You are invited to begin the shift and know that you are not alone. To learn more about the work Colby and his wife, Kate, are doing, visit ColbyMartinOnline.com. You can also visit SojournGrace.com to experience an affirming and safe space to heal, grow, and belong. Now sit back and relax and enjoy the conversation.
Tell us a little bit about your background, how you grew up, especially as it relates to faith and religion and the church.
So I still am one of three boys. I'm the middle child. And my dad came from a long line of Baptist folk, and my mom was a first-generation Christian. So when they got married, they were quickly absorbed into the Baptist world, and our family was in many ways that sort of typical at church multiple days a week, choir practice, youth group, Sunday morning service, Sunday evening service. And that, you know, lasted for 8 years or so until my parents divorced, and then my mom and us kids went to the Baptist church for a little bit after that, but, you know, this was the early 90s or late 80s, early 90s, and, you know, God bless the Baptist, but back then, like, divorce was a really big deal, so they didn't really know how to handle a divorce, a single mom and kids, so it was just weird. It was just weird. So we left that church, and she found us a generic evangelical church, and so that was where we went, still very religiously, third row, from the front on the left side every Sunday. And when I was in high school, going into my senior year of high school, I had an experience at a summer event for Utes and really found my life significantly altered. And what I mean by that is at that point, I was just kind of going to church because it was the thing my family did and it was just an activity. But on this event, I was confronted with the fact that I was pretending. I was a fraud. I was a fraud. I was just claiming to know about Jesus and claiming to be a Christian, but really had no sense of what that meant or no connection to God myself. And I came home from that event convinced that I had a new life calling, and it was to be a pastor, to go into ministry and to be a pastor. So I abandoned my plans to be a graphic designer on the East Coast. I like to say that part of my story as though that was a for sure thing going to work out. Like, I probably wouldn't have gotten into the school I was going to, like, I probably would have been a fail, but I like to say, like, I gave up my plans to go to Rochester Institute of Technology and be a graphic design star. What a sacrifice.
Gave it all up.
I did. Oh, Lord bless. So anyway, so that put me on a trajectory of, I wanted to be a pastor. And I still had Baptist roots. And so I went to a Baptist liberal arts college and got my degree in pastoral ministry from there, and began my, what has now been 2 decades of full-time ministry, and started out as a worship and arts pastor. So led the music on Sunday mornings and helped incorporate arts into our services. And that moved us from Oregon down to Arizona, spent there for about 5 years. And while I was down there, I'm getting out of the more interesting part of the story. While I was down there, I began this process of really for the first time asking questions of the faith that I was raised in and exploring new potential answers to those questions than would have been approved by my Baptist, you know, professors and previous youth pastors, and discovered, oh my goodness, like, the Christian tradition has within it a pretty significant diversity of thought, rather than this just sort of one narrow Baptistic evangelical tradition that had been handed to me.
Had this idea of questioning or wrestling or was it just not anywhere, whether it was in your studies or in the church communities that you were in, had it just never presented itself? Like, what is that? I guess it's because for me, I question every day. I'm questioning today as I'm writing a prayer to God, like why? So I'm just kind of, I'd love to explore that a little bit.
Yeah, it's such a great question. I think I have a few things to say by response. One is the world that I came from, like I said, Baptist evangelical world, places a high, if not highest, value on believing the right things, which is to say that there is this insistence that the most important thing to God is the ideas that we hold between our ears. And even to go so far as to say, like, your eternal destiny is contingent upon, do you have the correct belief about a particular thing? Like, this is what we've decided has become the most important thing to God, which I confess to you, I find a bit arbitrary and odd. Just as a parent myself, I can't really think of a time when the most important thing to me was that my kids knew the correct answers about who I was. Like, I don't know, whatever you think about me is whatever. You can have whatever thoughts you want, but do you know that I love you? Like, that's what do you know that you belong here in this family? Do you know that there's nothing that you can do to sort of stop being a child of mine? Like, these are the things that I find priorities, and most parents I have also discovered share some of the priorities. But anyway, so I think to respond to your question, there was such a high priority value insistence on correct belief and getting the answers right that there wasn't a lot of room for play, because at stake was your eternal salvation. So I don't know that it was explicitly ever said, don't ask questions. And yet, implicitly, it was, if you're going to ask questions, just know that these are the answers. Like, got to come back to this. Whatever questions you may ask, we already have the answers figured out. So don't go around thinking you're going to get a different answer. So that was really the culture, was everything's already figured out. Your job is to just memorize it and figure out how to defend it and figure out how to convince other people that you are right and they're wrong.
I'm totally resonating. Like, like all these memories of my childhood are, I remember one time I asked my youth director, I said, like, the gay, like, being in a same-sex relationship, I, like, didn't sit right in my, like, I was like, I don't know why the church is against this or whatever. And I was asking my youth director, and he looked at me like exhausted, and he's like, Chelsea, the Bible says so. Like, I should have known in my head the right answer, because the Bible said so. Like, it's totally what you're saying about having the right answer and no room for question. It's just, like, totally resonating. And I think it resonates with a lot of people grew up in that, like, no question, no wrestling, no participating, no, you got to know the answer and then defend it.
Yeah. I had a conversation recently with a pretty well-known evangelical apologist, and we were talking about this point exactly. And he the feeling I got was that he and or his audience felt sad for me that I grew up in a context in which questions weren't welcomed. And I kind of felt a little bit straw-manned a bit. Like, the point is not that it was this oppressive, no questions are allowed. It was that, like I said, all the answers are already sort of figured out and your job is to just acquiesce to them. That to me makes sense. Again, if your fundamental belief is that the most important thing to God is that we have the right ideas, then we have the right beliefs, then yes, I would imagine you should exhaust a lot of energy to make sure that the people you love most have those same beliefs. So that posture makes sense to me, which is why I don't necessarily hold as much of a begrudging posture against those who are adamant about raising their children to believe the right things and really hammering home that. It's really like, no, let's take one step back and say, why do you think that this matters so much? Like, let's start there. Let's start at this anxiety, this fear that you hold that we have to believe the right things in order for us to be okay with God.
But do you thought that as a kid? You thought that you were raised in this environment that was telling you to have the right answers was your pathway to heaven or whatever.
Yes, 100%.
How did you move from that?
I moved from that, I would say, by grace, which is to say, it's not always clear to me when I look back at the trajectory of my life, and I'm not sure I can take a whole lot of credit for the journey that I've been on. I'm not always sure why I made the shifts that I did and the moves that I did, and why I went in one direction and another brother of mine went in a different direction. Like, I don't know. Is some of that indicative of that I rank really high on the personality trait of openness? And so just by nature of my personality, I am open to new ideas. Maybe that's it. Is part of it that I have a skeptical bent to me, so that like just being told what to believe eventually is going to trigger this part of me like, what? Nah, it feels a bit like BS. Like, maybe some of that's personality driven. But I think a lot of it is just grace. Like, I don't know. I can't really take a lot. But I think maybe the question that you were probably fine with whatever response I give, but maybe more specifically, it was reading a series of authors and books and theologians that came from different traditions than mine, that really showed me, okay, there really have been throughout the history of the church faithful men and women who have asked really hard questions about the faith and really sincerely tried to figure out, who is God? Who are we? How do we relate to each other? How do we relate to the divine? They've asked these questions with sincerity. They've even done so with a Bible in hand, and come to different conclusions. And I think I got to a point where I realized there's just no way that one tradition, that one set of people, that one denomination has it figured out and the rest don't. There's just no way. I completely reject that as a possibility. So therefore, there has to be an okayness with asking questions. There has to be an okayness with not having the right answer. There has to be an okayness with having a multiplicity of answers. Maybe it's really just not about getting the right answer at all.
I was going to say, it may just be there is no answer.
It may be. Why not?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Who were some of the folks you were reading?
I blame Brian McLaren for getting me off the path, for taking me to the road of destruction that is wide. Although as I look back now, I'm like, actually, that's the narrow path. The one where you are courageously willing to examine your own belief structures and potentially be open to change. That's the narrow path, y'all. That's the one not many people take, but it leads to life. So Brian McLaren was the first one. His book, A New Kind of Christian, was the first time that I was given permission to not have an answer and to just say, I don't know. And then that led me to N.T. Wright, who's sort of a evangelical slippery slope figure to dislodge many of us evangelicals from our ways. So those are the two main ones that sort of theologically set me on a new trajectory.
Excellent. Right. Yeah. Like them both.
They're both straight white guys. So, you know,
many of them are.
That's just the time in my life. And that was what I knew. That was who I was going to come across. So I'm trying to figure out how to be less straight and white in my life.
We're all working. It's a work. We're constantly doing the work, as Brené Brown says. We're constantly doing the work.
Brené Brown, another straight white person. That's right. We just I love it. I love it. I'm not the anti-straight white person. I'm just mindful of how that has entirely informed me for most of my life. And just got to name it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I meet with a small group of young adult queer folk, and we went through Unclobber, and also you talk about it in The Shift. But what I think is kind of incredible about your story, and I think a lot of our audience is in this place of, okay, I'm starting to have these ideas about questioning, and maybe I give myself permission to do that internally, but my community is this conservative. My kids are in the Sunday school program. My friends all go there. How do I actually out loud say, I have questions about this thing? Or what if it could be something else? Like, how did you know what I'm saying? Like, there's a tension there that you hold between yourself and the community that I think a lot of people are anxious to make or are scared to make. And you risked a lot when you were having those questions, you know, it was like your livelihood. And so I just wonder if you could talk through that a little bit.
Yeah. The first place I want to start is to normalize that it makes a ton of sense that a person would carry some anxiety around that. Like, that makes a ton. Of course you would feel like, is it okay to be questioning this? Is it okay to be considering laying this belief down or picking up a new one or just really radically changing this one? That makes a ton. It's not that you are doing it wrong because you have some anxiety around it. It is hard. It is. And so the semblance of fear, the anxiety, the insecurity, the uncertainty, all that makes sense. So just, that's the first place I start, is don't add a layer of burden to yourself of, I shouldn't be, why am I so worked up about this? Well, you're worked up about it for really good reasons. So it's okay. And then for me, what I found really helpful in that time was really finding just one or two other people whom I had developed a relationship with, where there was trust and openness there, and really just kind of explore with them, you know, not taking it public, not trying to have some sort of big, larger conversation with the church community or the church leader or whatever your context is, but really just finding that one or two people and be like, hey, can we read this book together? Because I read it and it's really blown my mind, and I'd love to be able to process it with someone else. And really starting there is my suggestion. So normalize it in your own heart, and then start with one or two people that you know. And then eventually, I think what can happen over time is when we can dislodge in our own interior world the fear of an angry God who we have to appease by believing the right things, when we can sort of dislodge from that, then we can come out of our shell a little bit and know that, you know, maybe humans aren't going to like it as much if we believe different things or ask questions, but we can absorb that because we know on some level that God is okay with it. So I think that that internal work and that work of doing it with just a small group of people can help begin to heal some of those points inside of us where we fear God. And then when we can stop fearing God, now we're ready to, I think, to take on humans, which is a whole lot harder, in my opinion.
I think that's helpful advice. A lot of people we talk to, I'm thinking of a couple in particular, have read Unclobbered, and, you know, together as a group, what you're saying, and like kind of said, you know, okay, here's some wild ideas that like maybe this is a place we could go, and are still kind of in that spot of like, but how do we do this thing? And it's hard because there's not that many. I think there's starting to be, but there's not that many progressive, like really progressive places you can do that, especially in places of worship.
It's interesting because I wonder if it's harder for people to not fear being rejected by other people versus being rejected from God? I don't know, but I think because we're such simplistic, ego-filled, concrete individuals, I would think it would be very hard for someone to say, okay, these are my community. And if I start asking questions and if I start going down this, they're going to reject me. And how is that going to feel? Maybe God's going to reject me, but I'm wondering if more of the energy is placed on, this is my community. I know for me, the individuals that I talk to that are in those spaces, one of the first things they say is, it's never, I'm worried about God. It's, I don't want to lose my community.
My thought to that is, I completely agree. Completely agree with you and your assessment. And for many people, I would imagine that is the far, far bigger source of fear and anxiety. And I do wonder, though, if we could dissect, if we could get behind that a bit, if at the under, so this is where I think I was going, is behind all of those fears and insecurities is the deepest sort of existential angst that, am I okay just as I am as a being in this world? So we carry this sort of this existential angst around our very existence and our sense of well-being, and that oftentimes is connected and driven to, am I okay if there is a God, am I okay with that God? Will I be okay with that God? And that manifests then in a number of different ways, including the fear of a lack of belonging and a lack of connection, and lack of being okay with our fellow humans. So I do think that you're absolutely right that it manifests in that, oh my God, the community is going to reject me. But I think if we get underneath all of that, what we find at the base of it is this lack of security of just us as in our existence. It is my thinking, and I could be totally
wrong. No. I 100%. I am a big fan of preoccupation with self. And so I think that we're always looking to preserve ourself. Mm. And that means not fear of everything. Like, we don't want to be rejected in any way, shape, or form. We want to belong. We want to be loved. We want to be worthy. Yes. And we're constantly telling ourselves we're not good enough, right? We're not right. Smart enough. We're not lovable enough. Whatever, we're not, right? So 100%, yeah.
I think that's why we go to church too, is because there's a belonging there that we feel, you know, I mean, it's a hand and feet and arms of God too. Like, we feel this embrace that we're built for connection. So you went through your own kind of like your shift and you left the job at the very, or not very, but the conservative world. And I just, out of the gate, is it, you wrote Unclobber, which is like the hot button issue, especially of that time. Like, you were just like all, I mean, I just feel it's like all guns blazing type of a book, right? Like, what was the thought process? Like you just wanted to, like, why that topic?
So I was at that church in Arizona for 5 years, and it wasn't so much that I left there, but I was shown the door. So they fired me when they discovered that my theology had shifted as it relates to inclusion of LGBTQ folks. So that was one of the, if I think about my belief system as a Jenga tower, you know, from about 2007 to 2010, it was about 3 years of just slowly and methodically taking out the wooden blocks of my belief structure and asking questions of them, getting curious about them, examining them. And some of them I would just chuck off the table entirely. Like, I can't believe that anymore. Others I would maybe change a bit and put back on the tower. Like, I'll keep that one, but it's got to look different. And, you know, one of the significant pieces that changed in around 2010 was as it relates to affirmation of those who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, etc. And that one was certainly one of those Jenga blocks that if people know you have changed on, like, you're out in the evangelical world. Like, there might be some allowance for or grace for or room for things like, I believe in evolution and not literal creation. Okay, you can fit in this corner over here, or I believe men and women are equal and it's not this sort of imbalanced egalitarian. Okay. Yeah. We can fit you in this pocket over here. Like, there's some room and allowance for some, but if you go, if you cross the line on, you know, on queer inclusion, like you're out. There is no space in the evangelical world for that. And so in my church, I knew that. So I kept that to myself and just had, you know, like I mentioned a minute ago, one or two people for whom I processed this with. But then when it, you know, leaked out and the church found out about it, they fired me. And so then part of why, Chelsea, part of why I wrote Unclobber was because I felt there was a story in there to tell, a story of shifting on this particular topic that involved finding alignment between my head and my heart, which is to say my head was firmly entrenched in this theological position that to be gay is a sin and same-sex relationships will not be blessed by God. That was my head, firmly theologically entrenched in that. But then my heart had this posture of, yeah, but why aren't we a little more loving and accepting? This is weird. Like, aren't these just humans too? And so it tells the journey of finding alignment between the head and the heart. And I thought, I can imagine that's something that other people have experienced as well, and or would appreciate some assistance in said alignment. And then the other part was because shortly after getting fired, I was fielding a lot of questions on email and Facebook about the clobber passages, which is shorthand way of saying the six or so verses in the Bible that historically have been used to justify discrimination against those who identify as gay or lesbian. And what began is just like a blog series of like, all right, let me share with you the research that I found and sort of where I think about these things, eventually spun into a lecture series, which eventually then put together in a book proposal. And a publisher said, hey, if you want to tell your story and talk about the clobber passages, then we've got, we would love to publish that book. And I said, great, I'd love to write that book. Cause I didn't, that, again, why you mentioned it as like this sort of the hot button issue, like why that? I mean, that was the story I wanted. That was where I was at in life, right? That was the thing that I wanted to talk about. That was the thing that I felt mattered, the book that I believed I could write with integrity. And also, I was conscious that there was a lack of resources at that time. Now, obviously, in the last 5 years since the book came out, like the resource market has blown up and it's amazing and fantastic. But at that time, there was just not a ton of resources for people in the evangelical context who were trying to come out of that world and maintain theological integrity and have an open and affirming posture. So I thought maybe I could help.
I'm just impressed, like, but it is just such like a lightning ride. Like then you become the person that is in those, you know, are getting, I'm sure you got some not so nice emails and that kind of thing. Like you become the person that kind of fields all that. That's just what I was. I'm an Enneagram 9. So I try to avoid.
Okay. You're like, why would you do that to yourself?
The next book that comes out, the most recent book, is The Shift. And how does that fit into the narrative?
Yeah. So The Shift was my attempt to put together a sort of survival guide for shifting out of or away from conservative Christianity and towards something more open and progressive. Because it was an experience that in my, you know, last 8-9 years or so of ministry since getting fired from that church in Arizona and being in more progressive, open, affirming context, I realized, good gravy, there's a lot of folks that are making this shift. And it is complicated and it is fraught with obstacles. And if there's any way that I could help normalize that journey for people, which is to say, shifting out of that world and into something more progressive is a really hard journey to make. And just because it is hard for you doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It just is really hard. So I wanted to normalize that. And I wanted to say, here's several of the obstacles, theological obstacles, relational obstacles, inner like self obstacles with your own internal world. These are ones that if you haven't faced, you probably will. And if you already have, here's some ways that you might be able to help navigate that a bit. So that was really me looking back at the last, 6, 7, 8 years of ministry and saying, what is the thing that might help people make this shift? And that was where that book came from.
What has the feedback been like from that book?
Oh, it's been fantastic. It's been absolutely fantastic. People have been so grateful that they feel seen, they feel understood, they feel like they have some handholds now for where they're at, whereas they felt like they were just sort of floating in this space of, where am I? What's happening? What happened to my faith? I feel like I've lost my faith. And I opened the book by saying, I know you might feel like you've lost your faith, but that's only because you were told that faith is this very narrow set of beliefs. And if you challenge those beliefs, then now you don't have faith anymore. But faith is so much more than just a set of beliefs. Faith is also a verb. It's a posture. It's a way we orient ourselves in the world. It's a way of sensing that there's a light out there, and I want to remain open to wherever that light is and shift and turn and move towards that light. And so the fact that you believe radically different things now than you did 5 years ago is not a sign that you've lost your faith. It's actually a sign that your faith is working really well. Like, so good for you. And people have just really resonated with that. And it is like, oh, thank you for putting words to what my gut has felt, because my mind has been a bit all over the place on this.
Yeah, I'm thinking in my mind that yes, and I feel like this is exactly where, like, we're landing way back to the beginning. I think even before we started to record, with individuals moving in this space, but yet I think Chelsea and I discovered when we were doing this, or we did discover, is it's hard to find communities where you can actually practice this. So I think what I'm seeing for me is I'm seeing books, I'm seeing podcasts, I'm seeing conversations, I'm seeing online platforms. But where is the community? Like, that's what I continue to try and figure that out. I don't have an answer, but I we're even here we are in North County, San Diego, and it's challenging to find those progressive theological communities.
That's right. And for me, that makes a ton of sense. It's frustrating and it's sad. Like, I get emails on a weekly basis about, I read Unclobber, I read The Shift, and your church, Sojourn Grace, sounds amazing. Like, do you know one in my city that's like that I could try? And unless they live in Denver or Austin or Charlotte, you know, these select few cities that I'm connected with and know of, then most of the time the answer is like, I'm sorry, like, I don't know. There might be, but I don't know of one in your city. And I understand why that is on some level. And my conjecture on that is that, well, there's a couple things. One is that for many people who've shifted away from that type of Christianity, one of the main sources of their wounding is the church. And or church leaders, you know, they feel bamboozled by the church. They feel misled by church leaders. They feel, so when they think of church and they think of pastors, they think shame, they think judgment, they think that's the place that I never belonged. They kept wanting me to fit in, which is to say cut off parts of myself or edit parts of myself in order to fit in, but I never belonged there. And so then when they finally extract from that, yeah, like, it's almost the last place they want to go back to. So you need, in any sort of like movement theory, organization theory, you need a critical mass of individuals to sort of move a thing from a small grassroots movement to an institution that can sort of preserve the ideas and the progress of the movement. That requires a certain number of folk. And while those numbers are out there, they're not necessarily concentrated in an area at a percentage that would take something from a sort of grassroots organic movement to something that can be an institution, because whatever, half the people who might even make up that are like, I'm over the institution. Why would I go back? Why would I go back to this thing that wounded me? And the other half of us are just a little bit, off kilter enough to be like, but I think there's something here worth preserving and something worth, and that's obviously my position, is I actually think that there's something to this spiritual community organized around this regular meetup for spiritual practices, where you can find and experience belonging and authenticity and be reminded of your status as a loved child of God. Like, I think I don't think that's something we should just throw out. And yet it makes a ton of sense to me why people would not want to be a part of it anymore. And then even more so, as you probably know, why people wouldn't want to give their money to it. And that is honestly maybe 1A, 1B, when we talk about the biggest reasons why there's not more churches for folk like us, is the people themselves are a little bit like, I don't know that I want to get wrapped up in that. And then two, the money part, there's just no money for it. It's hard to raise money when people aren't afraid of hell. It's hard to raise money when people aren't feeling obligated to give to a God, thinking that God will bless me more now if I give money. Like, once you've removed these toxic theological ideas, it can be a challenge to inspire people to want to really invest into this thing called a church.
Wow. That I thank you very much. That was a excellent response. I mean, I don't think I've heard pieces of it from different individuals in different places, but I think you just put it right there. Amen. That's absolutely right.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, and I think also because there's so much shame around, you know, the question, I wonder how many people are really out there that their head is in that conservative space, but their heart is not. And like, because there's shame in asking questions, it's all silence and it's all underground. And I think that like books like yours and conversations like these are slowly giving people permission to say those things out loud. And like, I hear you on the money, but I think that like, that we're in such an interesting spot where it's like, I think church is going to look really different soon. Like it has to, right? And just like what that, the possibilities of that could be are really exciting also.
And I think this is why, like when we started talking, we talked about what are we doing as a gathered community? And right now we're finding, you know, dinner church has worked really well. I mean, people want to come together. And the other thing I would add is that they want to come together and they while they want to hear from what I'll call an authority figure, I'll leave it at that. It is what it is. Somebody has to facilitate the space, right? Priya Parker's book on gathering is great, but they also want to ask. They want to give, at least in my experience, they want to say, okay, yeah, but we have a question. Can we raise our hand in worship? Can we ask you something? Like if this is community, let's do it together. And the space has got to be created to do that.
I agree. Anyway. Yeah. Well said.
We actually had at our last dinner church, we had like all these things planned and then it just went off in this direction where people just were like, I disagree with that. No, I think it's this way. And it was just like, oh my gosh, this is what church like really could be. It's like, we were like wrestling over a scripture, like a story. And so it was inspired. It gave me a little like glimmer of hope because I do think there's something exciting, you know, coming.
I love that.
Yeah.
Do it. Get after it.
Okay. So staying on that same line of thought, but yet going down a little bit of, do you claim Christianity? Why stay in Christianity? Do you start to focus more on just incorporating all aspects of faith in different faith traditions?
Yes, I do still identify as a Christian, even though most of the internet and the YouTube world would like me to stop. thank you. I absolutely still identify as a Christian. And I'm conscious that a large part of that is just because I was born and raised in America in the 21st century. So like that was just, if I was born somewhere else, I would very likely be something else. And so it's in me. It's in me, and I'm making peace with it. And so that's a big part of why I am so Christian. But another big part of it is because we are, as humans, we are meaning-making machines. We need to make meaning out of the world around us. You know, there's research that of experiments where they've put people in front of a screen that it just has random triangles just bouncing around the screen in no particular pattern at all. And yet, predictably, the people observing will create a story and create patterns and like have a whole reason for why the triangles are going in the direction. Like we are just meaning making, we need stories to make sense of our life. And for me, the story, at least as I am currently interpreting it and receiving it, the story of the Judeo-Christian narrative can be a really compelling and a really interesting and a really valuable story. And what I mean by that is it helps us make sense of what it means to be human, helps us make sense of what it means to relate to one another. It gives us North Stars in terms of how might flourishing as a human being look like. And it's a really compelling story for me. It includes a highlight and an emphasis on the marginalized and the outsiders and the impressed. Like, that is a really, really compelling narrative to me. And so I'm still here. I'm still in it. I still think there are themes worth redeeming and ideas worth dusting off and preserving. I'm not really interested in looking at the last 10,000 years of human civilization and saying, yeah, thanks for all the hard-earned lessons that you have worked on. Thanks for all the insights that you've gained and all the archetypes of what it means to be human. Appreciate that, but I'm going to go ahead and toss that all out and start fresh. Why? It just seems to me like a really bad idea, a really bad idea. So anyway, yes. So I have a soft spot for Christianity, but I know that that's just a lot of it's culturally driven.
What would be your dream for the church as we move forward? Like, what would you really want the church to be?
My dream for the church is that she would take seriously the idea in the book of 1 John, that perfect love casts out fear. I get the sense that so much of church world is driven by fear. Fear of no longer existing, fear of losing money, fear of losing prestige, fear of losing power, fear of getting it wrong, fear of being challenged. Just so much fear in the church, just rampant with fear. And if we can start loosening our grip on that and really settling into love, I wish Chelsea that someone would have just asked Jesus, because I really feel like this would have helped a lot. I wish somebody would have asked him, all right, level with us, because there's a lot of things going on here in this religion. There's a lot of ideas, a lot of teachings, a lot of commands. Can you just help us to know what the most important one is? Like, I wish to God someone would have asked him that. Because my hunch is he would have suggested.
Do you think that
I don't know?
You don't know?
Conjecture. I don't want to put too many words into the lips of our Lord and Savior. Yeah. But my conjecture is he would have said the most important thing is to love people. And really just see all other things as secondary. And maybe he would have even said, love God. But I think he might have done that from a vantage point of trusting that's really, 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 really complicated. Because what does that even mean? So he might have been like, love God is the most important thing. But while you're figuring that out, or maybe what it means is to just learn to love other people and love yourself. Love yourself so that you can love other people. Oh, and if you really are ready for black belt, then love the people that are the hardest to love. You might call them your enemies. You might call them the people that curse you. Anyway, so I just wish somebody would have asked Jesus these questions, because then he could have given us some insight into what mattered most. So my hope for the church.
Why didn't somebody write that down?
It would have been really helpful. Instead, we're stuck like figuring out what is the most important thing. Is it Trinity? Is it how to take communion? Is it celibacy in the ministry?
Is it no women in leadership? No.
So anyway, that's my dream, is that the church would loosen her grip on fear and would realize that really love is the thing that matters most, and trust then that's enough. And that all the other things about, will the organization still exist? Will I still have a paycheck? Will there still be people that show up for community groups and small groups? Will we still have mission organizations? Really trust that all of those are actually really, really good things. They are. They're really good things. They're good systems in a world. And we've tapped into something these last 2,000 years that has an incredible sustaining power. Like, it's a miracle that the idea of church still is with us. Like, there's something about this rhythm, this pattern, this way of organizing, this way of being community that clearly has tapped into a thing in the existence of humanity that that works. So that's why I'm not too quick to throw it out. But I think it really needs to come from a place of love and not fear.
Well, Colby, thanks for your time. Hopefully one of these days we can actually bring you up or come down or get together. It would be fun. Yeah. So, but we're so appreciative of your time and your work, and we're going to continue to watch and follow. And we're excited for our audience to hear from you as well. So thank you.
Right on. Thank you, Chelsea. Thank you, Dana.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Just like everyone we are interviewing throughout this series reflects the sacred and holy image of God, so do you. Together, we are what God looks like.
The Collective Table is supported by San Diego United Methodist Church in Encinitas, California.
A big thank you to the team at Castos, especially our producer Stuart Barefoot and our content editor Claire Watson.
The original music heard in this episode was created and performed by Mystic Mercy.
Make sure to subscribe to the podcast, YouTube channel, and our newsletter.
If you'd like to financially support the work of The Collective Table, please visit thecollectivetable.org. There you can also find out more about who we are and view past episodes.